Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It's an irony of our calendar that by the time Lollobrigida swings around once again in its reassuring way, bringing with it the promise of longer days and of nature renewing itself, our own personal attempts to begin afresh and reinvent ourselves have probably failed yet again. For by now, most of those New Year resolutions we made at the end of December have been quietly shelved, packed away for another year, like the Christmas decorations. Just as St. Augustine wanted to be made pure, but not just yet, most of us, despite wanting to be improved versions of ourselves, have happily yielded to our favourite sources of temptation. Perfection has been postponed. Still, the desire to reinvent ourselves seems to lie at the heart of what we are. What else could explain the surge in gym memberships in January, or the stampede to enrol in language classes in September? The belief that we can remake ourselves in 8 or 12 weeks is the product of the delusion that we are perfectible, rather than being, in fact, permanently flawed. At some level, we are persuaded there is another, truer version of ourselves, waiting to be summoned forth from the shadows, one that can bench press our own body weight while speaking fluently in Italian or Japanese. This notion of there being multiple versions of ourselves is perhaps what Yeats was getting at with his belief that the poet and the man were two separate entities. The poet, he wrote, is never the bundle of accident and incoherence that sits down to breakfast. I suppose he meant that the sausages and black pudding are consumed by the man, though it is hard to picture Yeats eating a sausage. The poet, on the other hand, Yeats says, is an ideal, something intended, complete. And this is true of many celebrities. Anyone who attends table quizzes with any regularity knows that Elton John was born Reginald Dwight and that John Wayne was originally Marion Morrison. And while technically Elton and Reg Dwight are one and the same, it's obvious that the flamboyant performer with a weakness for ludicrous glasses, singing Tiny Dancer, is the stellar Elton, rather than the earthbound Reg. Similarly, it's the rugged John Wayne, rather than the gender-ambiguous Marion Morrison, who drags the lovely Maureen O'Hara 5 miles across the fields in The Quiet Man. Reg Dwight, Marion Morrison, yes, sometimes we all need to be reinvented. F. Scott Fitzgerald understood this need for reinvention. The central moment of The Great Gatsby is when the opportunistic James Gatz sheds his skin and transfigures into glamorous J. Gatsby. The 17-year-old Gatz notices Bill Cody's luxury yacht moored at a dangerous spot. It was James Gatz who had been loafing along the beach that afternoon, but it was already J. Gatsby who borrowed a rowboat and informed Cody that a wind might break him up in half an hour. For Gatz, the rest, you might say, is fiction, complete fiction. Such extreme forms of reinvention are not confined to literature. Micheál MacLiomore, actor, director, writer and professional corkman, entertained the country for more than 50 years with his talent and wit. His mellifluous speaking voice, fluent Irish and general carry-on suggested a childhood spent frolicking along the highways and byways of the Cork countryside in the company of bards and shanachie. The truth, however, is that, like Gatsby, MacLiomore sprang from his platonic conception of himself. Originally Alfred Wilmore, born in the London suburb of Willesden, he decided at 17, the same age that James Gatz decided to become Gatsby, that he would much prefer to be Irish. So he set about learning the language, came to Ireland with a fictional family history and a new name. Micheál MacLiomore was born. In our annual attempts at reinvention, most of us have neither the determination nor the grand vision of Gatsby or MacLiomore. We make do with modest proposals that involve shedding a few pounds rather than an entire identity. By February, many of us have cheerfully accepted failure. we've reverted to being slightly overweight bundles of accident and incoherence. Yet, next December, a voice will call out and urge us on again into the following year. That voice sounds irritatingly like Beckett's in Worsted Ho. Ever tried, ever failed. No matter. Try again. Fail again. Fail better.
Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
Today I went for a run. It's my 14th day in a row of running. I don't run far and I don't run fast, but I run. If possible, I run in the morning. Early, before work. This sets you up for the day and results in a smug glow which follows you around until at least lunchtime, if not beyond. I run laps of the small green in front of my house, in an estate of a Dublin suburb. I do this even in the rain, and I no longer care what the neighbours think, as I did when I started running. I run out of my estate, along the road and around Pierce Park, where I am met by historical artefacts and signposts telling me about Ireland's founding fathers, a history I wasn't taught during my school years in England. I run past the school that my children didn't get into due to oversubscription. At the height of my enthusiasm, I run to the library to return a book and run back home again. I run past the Undertaker's that used to be a pub, which my husband and I once fantasised about owning. I run through the present and into the past, running past the house we used to live in and streets my children used to play on. Perhaps I'm running into the future, past schools they may one day attend, churches they may marry in, houses we might live in one day in years to come. In the summer, when the evenings were long and my energy greater, I ran past Pierce Park, up the hill and into Marley Park. I would run through the park, slowly, slowly, as the path inclines and out the other end. I would think about all the walks I have done in the park over the years, with my children when they were small and a trip to the park was a day's event, with a friend during COVID when it was the highlight of the week. It's remarkable to me, the fact of this running. At school, I loathed the cross-country running sessions we were forced to do during PE classes. Cross-country being something of a misnomer, given we were doing short loops of a small satellite town in the northeast of England and not long-distance runs up hills and down dales. Surely these sessions were designed as a punishment by some evil PE teacher. I could barely get through one without doubling over on the side of the pavement, clutching my side due to cramps. Who would ever do such a thing voluntarily? After that, I tried running several times as an adult, but was never able to manage it. There was always some message my body would send telling me to stop, this is not for you. Shin splints and fallen arches, heavy legs and your face overheating. Then last year, some random Wednesday in July, I decided that walking wasn't enough. It was important to me suddenly to get going, to move faster. I needed a buzz that my usual trudge around the neighbourhood couldn't provide. So I started to run. First, as far as the second lamppost, and then as far as the roundabout, then the petrol station, then the park, then round the park, and back again. My favourite place to run now is Montpellier Hill, up to the Hellfire Club at the edge of Dublin suburbs, where city becomes countryside. I run up the hill, slowly, very slowly. You might hardly call it running if you saw me. When I get to the top, I can look down on all of Dublin, the city, the bay, the Poolbeg Towers. Then I take a deep breath, I will probably take a photo or two, and turn around and run faster on the way home, because it's all downhill from there.
soft, dark rain misted on soft, dark nights, like a gentle country voice with none of the insistence of the cold city. I love the dark under lights so you can see it, the wet foliage glistening in the damp, dark, mild evening, prelude to dark you can't see. The time of the dark nights is magic for me. October, November, December, January, when fallen leaves are mulchy with falling rain. I was born in November, and I feel the dark time of year in my blood. I was born in a rainy city and moved to a rainy countryside, from Manchester to Sligo. Rather, I was moved. I was 6 years old, myself and my sister, squished in the back seat of a boxy Morris Traveller, transported like the stacked boxes by our sides, squashed together. I've a memory of wearing the itchiest pants known to time. It's my abiding memory, extremely itchy, uncomfortable pants, on a drive from Manchester to the ferry and o'er the sea by ferry, then from the ferry and on to Sligo. Considering the length of my life, it seems I have few memories. 10 a year? How life lived evaporates in the darkness of the mind. I remember the city lights bright, then disappearing as the night reclaims the space, and then again the city lights, and then the dark, like long, slow blinks over the vision of space and time, the slow blink of time. Do I remember, or do I recreate, from other times, from the times of others? As a comedian, I replicated that night journey, coming back from shows all over Britain to my then home of London. From trains and cars, the lights gathered round cities and towns like ancient armies encamped, waiting till daylight to invade. Or I'd take night planes, moving between Ireland and England to work, seeing from above the black cloth of places, a giant jewellery box with the twinkling diamonds of urban lighting systems. Where is memory seen from? My father travelled all over Britain in the 50s and 60s, painting giant cinemas. He spent months painting the Forth Bridge in Scotland. We have memories and memories of memories and rememberings of rememberings of rememberings. This is our personal history, pillars we hold tight to in the choppy waters of life as they become part of our identity, the illusion of who we are, buried in the swampy waters of the past. A hugely uncomfortable journey at the dark nighted time of year, October to early November. I know, because not too long after we arrived in Ireland, I had my 7th birthday, November the 6th, 1971. And the car drove into the giant garage of the ferry, and we went upstairs to the cabins. Did we have a cabin? My mother had a cabin once in the 50s or 60s with her friends coming back from work in England to Mayo. Is that what I'm remembering? No clear picture of this ferry, just a construction from all the other ferries from different generations. And when I go there and try to shine a light, the mind reflects back a dark abyss which represents most of what I thought and did and lived. The night sea choppy with its crashing crests of foam. It's funny how little we remember of most of our life. Where does all that living go? Once upon a time, 2 weeks ago to be exact, I was in a sweet shop, one of those that recreate ye old sweet shop that used to exist, or did they? And there I saw it, a rich toffee globe with a dark brown glow and a stick you held to give it a lick. Treacle. That's the lolly I had in my hand one Guy Fawkes night in Manchester. My mother holding my other hand. It was bonfire night and a friend's birthday. I remember being small and pulled through the night with fireworks going off in the dark skies and into the sitting room lit and warm with the young birthday boy and friends, and back out and falling in love with the dark and the warmth and the light come to life only in relation to the dark, to luxuriate in one wrapped in the other, and the world is endless and huge as a dark sky to the small boy handheld, with no worry of how or where he was going.
The 2nd of February, 1914, marks a significant event in cinema history. On that day, an English comedian first appeared in moving pictures in a short film called Making a Living. He played a charming swindler called Edgar English and sported a top hat, a monocle, a large drooping moustache, and a cane. The picture received a moderate response, although the actor playing the swindler was singled out for praise. His name was Charlie Chaplin, and little did cinema-goers know that February 2nd that worldwide fame for him was just around the corner. Before joining the Keystone Film Company, Chaplin had been on his second exhausting tour of America with music hall impresario Fred Karno's theatrical troupe of comedians. Charlie was the young star of the show, which was full of talented performers. One possibly apocryphal story goes that one time he decided to take a few days off, feigning illness and letting his understudy take over. Then, on hearing that this understudy was getting bigger laughs, Charlie made a remarkable recovery and returned to work. The said understudy, Stanley Jefferson, would also be wooed by the cinema and would later change his name to Stan Laurel. While February 2nd was a significant date in Chaplin's professional career, the 1st of February, St. Bridget's Day, could be said to hold a special significance in his personal life. St. Bridget was reputed to hail from Louth, and in the mid-1930s, Dundalk playwright Paul Vincent Carroll wrote his play Shadow and Substance about an old priest's housekeeper, also called Bridget, who has visions of her saintly namesake. The play was first performed at the Abbey Theatre in 1937, and the following year, a production in America played for 8 months on Broadway, winning the New York Critics Circle Award for Best Foreign Play. The great part of the old Canon Skerritt was played by Sir Cedric Hardwicke and young Bridget by Julie Hayden, who incidentally went on to play the first Laura Wingfield in The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams. Having finished work on The Great Dictator in 1941, Chaplin was looking around for a new subject, and Sir Cedric suggested Shadow and Substance. No doubt recognizing in the canon a wonderful part for himself, Chaplin spent the guts of a year writing a screenplay adaptation. Always on the lookout for young female talent, he was introduced at a dinner party to a teenage actress called Una O'Neill, daughter of playwright Eugene. Thinking her perfect for the role of Bridget, he also fell madly in love with her. And they planned to marry once filming of Shadow and Substance was out of the way. However, while they did indeed get married and lived happily together until his death on Christmas Day, 1977, plans to film Shadow and Substance were shelved, and Chaplin made Monsieur Verdoux instead. but back to February 1914, and within a week of that inauspicious debut film, two more Chaplin films were released, Mabel's Strange Predicament and Kid Otto Races in Venice, California. For these pictures, however, Chaplin had found the baggy pants and tight coat, the small bowler hat and large shoes, the little moustache and cane that were to become his trademark look. The little tramp was born, and Chaplin's fame spread the world over, making people laugh and cry in equal measure. On a personal note, my grandfather, as a young man, played violin in the Cozy Corner Cinema in Armagh, his sister Bella on piano, accompanying the latest silent movie releases, many of which no doubt featured the little tramp. I like to think of my grandfather fiddling away there with a smile on his face at the antics of the little man on screen. And when my grandfather married and became a father, his first child, a son, my father, just had to be christened Charlie.
If you're ever in a hurry, driving in County Kildare, don't go through the Curragh. Why? Sheep. Yes, sheep rule the roost on the Curragh of Kildare. They're everywhere. They love to graze on the broad swathe of crunchy short grass. Well, they're herbivores after all, and the Curragh is commonage, so that whenever and wherever sheep are grazing, they are perfectly within their rights. The rules of commonage state that there can be no fences to keep the grazers in check, and sheep sometimes tend to wander. An open garden gate along the road is considered to be an invitation to lunch, but they return to their home ground, for there's no better grazing than on the plains of Kildare. Sometimes when I pause there, I find myself humming one of my favourite pieces of music, Bach's Where Sheep May Safely Graze. They're placid creatures, and yes, indeed, those sheep can take a while to decide whether to cross the road or not. They might even change their minds in the middle of the road and rest there. Nothing will move them. They can even stop a tank in full battle mode. And tanks and other armoured vehicles appear regularly on the Curragh. All 5,000 acres of the Curragh belong to the Department of Defence. For hundreds of years, soldiers were trained there, but it was when an official camp was set up to prepare troops for action in Crimea in 1854, it became more permanent. Eventually, better living quarters to house the soldiers were constructed in glorious red brick. Today, you must take heed of red flags and sentries who warn you that you could be in danger when too close to a firing range. You might come across a line of soldiers weighted down by huge backpacks jogging across the flat land. Night manoeuvres are usually silent and can be a bit daunting if you're confronted by a platoon in full regalia. Sheep rolled up like white fur cushions sleep their way through it all. But the Curragh is a lot more than grass, sheep and soldiers. I heard a discussion on radio a while ago about the dwindling supply of fresh water in Dublin. A contributor to the programme suggested that the Curragh could be drained to solve the problem. And I wondered, Where is the water to drain from the Curragh? Apparently the Curragh is an aquifer. The definition of an aquifer, I'm told, is a body of porous rock, sand and gravel, saturated with groundwater. Water enters it as rainfall and seeps through the soil. It can move to all the nooks and crannies and resurface through springs and wells. I wonder, would the whole Curragh collapse if that water is drained to supply the city of Dublin? The meaning of the word Curragh is a place where horses race, and they certainly do race there, big time. One of the most delightful sights I have ever witnessed was on an early morning walk. I heard what I took to be the sound of thunder, when out of the morning mist a herd of seemingly wild horses came toward me. Sleek thoroughbreds they were, their riders putting them through the exercise regime for the races to come. Oh yes, the Curragh is not just grass and sheep. You'll find wildflowers in certain areas. The golden furze is overabundant and has to be cut back occasionally to keep it in control. There are wild orchids, bog cotton, sphagnum moss and blushing waxcap mushrooms to be discovered if you know where to look for them. And all the while, the great round tower and medieval church watch over the Curragh from a distance. Bridget's legacy to the plains of Kildare, as her feast day is marked with national celebrations. The Curragh of Kildare is not just grass and sheep. It's valued greatly for its archaeology, its aquifer, its mysticism. Oh, I could be here all morning telling you about the military museum, the strangely hilly golf course, Donnelly's Hollow. Come someday to where sheep may safely graze and see so much more.
The winter it is past, and the summer's come at last, and the birds they are singing in the trees.
This week, these last few days of January slipping into February, I've been putting away the candles and candle holders. Most of them, I've kept a few out. We've lit a lot of candles this winter, their flames glowing inside heavy glass tea light holders, blue and yellow, shining white in proper candlesticks, refracted and broken into gleaming shards from within the cut glass candle holder my mother gave me. And outside too, on frosty nights, shining inside the IKEA lanterns in the garden. Lots of candles. We've turned the lights off and struck a match instead. We've gone with the grain of the season. We've relaxed into this time of shadows, putting up no resistance. We've let winter enfold us. Shadows. This winter, I've been reading In Praise of Shadows, by the Japanese writer Tanizaki. This book does what it says on the cover. It reminds us that shadows and darkness are necessary elements of life, that a point of light will shine all the brighter against a deep velvet backdrop. Tanizaki writes about the place of shadows in domestic life, in public spaces, in music and literature and film, in the quotidian, the everyday. Reading this book, I was taken back in my mind to a shadowy side street in Japan, in Kyoto, strolling with Japanese friends, commenting on the dimness of Japanese streets and streetlights, which runs so counter, of course, to our idea of Japan as a place of neon, of flashing lights, of brilliant illumination. As we walked along this side street and chatted, a geisha emerged from the darkness, clacking on her wooden shoes, her face white like a ghost, going about her business against the context of shadow, and then vanishing into the shadows again. A little learning that I carried home with me, that darkness brings light to life, so that, yes, this winter I've embraced the darkness, or rather, embraced the effect that tiny points of light can have on darkness, bringing restfulness, atmosphere, ease, banishing the gloom. Were it not for shadows, Tanizaki reminds us, there would be no beauty. Of course, we already know all about this in Ireland. We always did, even if modern life has sometimes come close to making us forget. So many of our seasonal traditions are attuned to the balancing of light and darkness in our lives. And I'm mindful of this deep past as I look around the rooms today, as I clean candlesticks, as I wash the tea light holders and put them away, or put some of them away, and welcome the coming of the light. Outside, the snowdrops have been pushing up through the soil and now they're in bloom, and the first early narcissi will be with us soon. Outside, the light has been returning stealthily these past few weeks, and now, these opening days of February, this hinge in the year, it gives up its stealth and declares itself suddenly, regardless of the weather. This February moment is about looking up again, looking out again, watching the light fall in a different way, just slightly different, but inescapably different. In our garden, light inches along the walls now day by day, and soon it will be marching. The darkness slips away again into corners. We are at the midpoint between the winter equinox and the spring solstice, and better days are coming. And today, of course, the 2nd of February, is Candlemas, a Christian festival in which candles are blessed for use throughout the rest of the year, and a festival that, like so many other such dates in the Christian calendar, is deeply rooted in a much larger and more ancient context. In France, Candlemas is cheerily linked to the making and scoffing of pancakes. Across Europe and now North America, it's associated with Groundhog Day, where a hibernating creature peeks its nose out of the burrow and cautiously sniffs the air to see if winter is over yet. And in Ireland, of course, this day has always been entwined with Imbolc and Brigid and the beginning of our own spring. As the rhyme has it, on Candlemas Day, throw the candle and candlestick away. The sun rises higher in the sky every day, and the work of the year begins. Today, then, I think about and sense and feel this change in the air, this hinge in the year. I put our candles away, and our candle holders too, and I welcome the light. But not completely, not entirely. Let's not wholly banish the shadows, and let's welcome them back when autumn comes around once more. The dark is good too. Happy Candlemas.
On this morning's programme, we heard Fail Again, Fail Better by Cunnell Hamill, Running Up That Hill by Beth Kilkenny, In Praise of Dark Nights by Kevin Gildee, Charlie was by Carl O'Neill, Where Sheep May Safely Graze was by May Leonard, and At Candlemas by Neil Hegarty. The music was Slip Sliding Away by Paul Simon, a piano version of Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill played by Henry Smith, The Seas Are Deep by Carolyn, performed by the Mikhail Chromik Ensemble, Chance Meeting from the film Gold Rush with Charlie Chaplin, and The Curragh of Kildare, sung by the Johnstons. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back on the RTE radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.